All right, so we're looking at some cool projects down here in the shop on Adam's laptop, and he was just telling me something.
Yeah, so what I want my job to be going forward is consulting with the frame builder in the way that that I would design it in comparison to their design. So we can look at two different ways of achieving the same task, but bring in manufacturability and then testing, ride testing with the product to get to a better goal or get to a better result. So like with this project that we're looking at now, this is a replication, but I'm replicating an aluminum bike in steel. So I'm going through all of the manufacturing challenges in working around a bike that was originally designed for, you know, giant hydroform tubing to where we can achieve the same tasks but with steel tubing. Easier to iterate on getting the bike to feel a certain way, because we could make five of these cheap rather than like trying to source
five bikes of differing geometries or two leverage ratios or whatever you want.
So not even looking at leverage ratios, keeping the variables only
chassis flexure.
Exactly, chassis flex. Yeah,
but one thing you said there about this is your way of doing it, this is the way I'd do it, you know, and you know, you discussed some people you're trying to work with, but when it comes to like when I discuss things, of course I've got a personality problem, but like when I talk to people that are new and say, oh, that's not the way to do it, they instruct me on the right way to do it, and I'm like, you have no fucking clue what you're talking about. But then you're talking about clients that actually have a level of expertise that in maybe their selected fields that few others have, and you're going to be in a situation where, let's say, the kinematics expert is going to start trying to force their opinion of fabrication methods versus, you know, that kind of thing where someone's maybe stepping a little outside of their range and flexing a little bit in terms of team status and things like that, and you'd be dealing with that. And there's going to be a situation up that, because they always come up, where you're actually right, there's no doubt about it, but you're contending with egos. How do you think that goes down?
Well, so engineers aren't always right. Riders have seen some shit. And I'm kind of in the middle of that range where I've seen both ends. So I know how to get to the result without a lot of going the wrong direction, I guess. So I've worked with a lot of engineers that have helped a process really develop. But I've also done I've done a lot in just riding the bike and iterating in a I'm not an engineer, like, at all. Like, I don't do FEA on parts. So I figure a lot of things out based on longevity of something or how it feels. So being able to translate, that's really difficult. But when you get a couple people together that know how to talk the same talk and walk the same walk, then you can start to iterate on something and change small variables where it's not like, we're changing 10 variables on a bike. It's like we're going to change just the tubing and see what the tubing feels like.
Everything doing single else, parameter testing and all that type of thing.
Yep. We know exactly how the suspension is going to feel as related to spring rate and how it you know, supports you in a...
How is it damped?
Right.
That kind of stuff. You'll want to change the other stuff.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean...
Well, it's interesting hearing about these projects. I'll leave them unnamed.
Yeah,
but it's pretty cool. It sounds like you've already got a running start on being maybe a tuner to the stars type of thing.
Yeah, that's. I guess that's a.
I mean, I talk a lot about that bicycling doesn't have tuners, and granted, tuners aren't fabricators, but like you know, in motorsports or motorcycling, we have tuners that really get down to, you know, the bottom of setup and making decisions that the rider is clouded by, and in a way you can bridge a gap where someone that lacks your level of professionalism in terms of production of getting it done, getting it made, and you can get that done quick. You know how to get it done well. You can move them forward quickly and let them focus on what they're good at.
Yeah, and I've ridden a lot of bikes. I have been on like the Reeb platform for the past couple years, but I still have that that riding ability to truly isolate chassis feel. But I'm excited to work with all of these new platforms. Like, I've been talking with the guys at 3VO to get one of their rear ends to just start to learn all of the different kind of the small up and comings to understand what is current in the bike industry at a manufacturer's level right now. I don't care what all the new bikes do with the high pivot stuff. Like, it, I want to get down to being able to ride somebody else's design, but then bring my own manufacturing capabilities into it.
And I think what's interesting, like what you're talking about though, is like kinematics. It's like, I think kinematics is interesting to know about or learn about, but the design of a kinematic system has lots of factors in it that are well outside of what makes it go better. But the thing is that what we discussed earlier regarding my frame fixture type of thing, where there are certain kinematic systems that if the pivot deviates 1 millimeter, it blows up.
Mm-hmm.
And other systems where it can deviate 5 millimeters, it just doesn't matter. And if you're able to recognize that difference and be knowing, oh, I'm in this environment, I need to double up on precision or it won't work at all, or we're in this environment, we can just work fast.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Kinematics has never been, I've never really gotten into the weeds on kinematics. I'll know what leverage ratio feels like with different spring rates and different tunes, like damping tunes on shocks, but we've never really needed to, you know, reinvent the wheel.
The bike problem isn't that hard.
Yeah, and like I've been riding on a horse link bike, and I like a poppy, playful bike. Horse links are really good at that.
Right. Do you like it nimble too?
Right.
Sick.
But you know, linkage-driven bikes can change a lot of things. But I've never really even needed to go down that path because the platform that we had was good, and we didn't need to spend, you know, a ridiculous amount of time, you know, making extremely small changes. We could make better changes that translate to a better product through, you know, manufacturability and just resilience of the bike.
I'm in full agreement. I just push it toward geometry. It's like too many people talking about kinematics, not enough people talking about geometry.
Yep.
Or not enough people doing something about geometry.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll check out of this because I hear your dog barking.
Yeah.
All right, you're just telling me about this sick reamer. Tell me more. Who made it?
So Chadwick and Trefethen is a reamer manufacturer, and they will make you whatever you want. And luckily,
how much did it cost, though?
$350.
That's not bad considering what you're describing. Describe it.
So it was a 20-inch long reamer. And
spiral flute?
It was left-hand cut spiral flute.
Why left?
Because you're on an interrupted cut in a weld. So a left-hand cut, well, spiral is for the interrupted cut. A left-hand is so the frame doesn't get pulled into the reamer. A left-hand cut will resist.
Oh, the spiral's opposite the cutting direction.
Correct.
That's sick.
Yeah, so that way, when you have a weld that's 10 inches down in a seat tube.
So you're doing a right-hand rotation,
correct,
but the spiral is going left. And
yes,
that makes it so that you don't
grab.
I call that screwing in.
Yeah.
Like when you drill into sheet metal or something like that.
Yep.
Oh, that's cool.
We've never reamed a seat tube by hand. The reamer's always in a lathe spindle, and you have the front triangle in your hands.
So it could run ahead of you and crush a frame if you were wrong.
You'd be surprised. You can, I mean,
on a right-hand spiral,
yeah,
it could run ahead,
correct,
if it grabbed just so.
Yeah,
but with this, it wouldn't.
I mean, people like us, we could overcome a 3-horsepower spindle or the grip that a 3-jaw chuck is on a reamer. But we also use adjustable reamers to rough.
Or use oven proof.
So we would actually weld an extension onto an adjustable reamer to get all the way down into the frame, and then we would finish ream with a, it was no more than $400, full custom reamer. But it's nice because...
That's so sick.
The custom reamer was 34.9, so it was a regrind from an inch size. So they just reground it to 31.6.
Yeah.
But it was also a learning experience of what a really sharp... So this was an aluminum frame. So what a really sharp reamer will do, if it's on size, it might cut a little bit big if the seat tube is warped, because it'll be influenced by the tubing. But we had pilots on the exit of the reamer, so the reamer would stay straight in the frame as it went all the way down. Long seat tubes are a chore.
They're interesting animals, and like, you know, you're saying about adjustable reamers. It's like, since I worked at Fat City, the reaming on a Fat City was the best there was.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they probably still are the best, what we did there. Because those were like three reams, all spiral flute, cut to size reamers, mm-hmm. where you had a rough, an intermediate, and a finish reamer.
Yeah.
And I think even in final assembly, they probably honed it then.
Yeah.
You see a lot of people doing adjustable reamers on bikes. And mm-hmm. it's like, they're utterly garbage, and like you got to get away from that as soon as you possibly can. And I use an adjustable for my roughing.
Yeah,
you should see the condition of this reamer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I take it to bench grinders and shit, and it's just like the most Neanderthal looking thing, because it's like, I don't give a fuck, break through that weld. You know,
4130 chromoly weld is extremely hard, and
hear it go crack.
I bet, man, 5 years at Reeb, I bet we went through, I don't know, 30 adjustable reamers.
Uh-huh.
But you have them in your McMaster card all the time, and they're right. $100. So I mean, it'll do, especially when we move to steel front triangle.
But then you're sacrificing those so that your two size reamer stays nice.
Exactly.
Because that's the money shot.
Yeah, and I mean, depending on the seat post, they're not all 31.6. They're 31.5, they're 31.7. You kind of have to ream. So like, we essentially tried to sell every bike with a one-up dropper, because it was the most affordable dropper it was the best bang for the buck. They're great.
It still is. That's what I use exclusively, because it's the best.
Nothing.
It's the best because of value.
I would say I have nothing bad to say about it, and it's cheap.
I have something bad to say about it. It's just lubrication.
Yeah.
Is that it pumps lubrication out, and then it ends up unlubed.
Yeah.
And it's like, you got to kind of, you do have to stay on it versus like...
Pack some honey butter in there.
Yeah, versus like other systems that I've used where it's like, they were fine for a long time. But that's the only thing I can say bad about them, because otherwise they're fucking dope.
Yeah, so one-ups are, I would say, on size or slightly big. So we would try to ream all the frames specifically to a one-up dropper. For a long time, we had a dummy one-up to check frame fit.
That was the biggest one you knew.
And then I measured it and had a centerless grinding shop make a 4140 post-hard, or it was a pre-hard 4140 shaft. I had them grind it to the one-up seat post diameter spec. So we were using essentially a go gauge, but it was hard. Because if you put a one-up dropper into 200 frames, it's going to get small.
Yes, that's true. So you guys were using 34.9. Now, that's what you're saying?
No, so when we were aluminum frames, we had a 34.9 ID seat tube shimmed to 31.6 to prevent any misalignment in the frame that would wreck seat dropper.
Got it. Because I did, my wife specialized recently, and I was like, oh, I'm going to get a one-up 34.9 post, because that'll be sick. They'll probably boost up the pillar part in diameter and make it lighter, because it's larger diameters and it'll be better. No, it was exactly the same size. All they did was increase the wall thickness.
Yep.
And I was like, well, this is stupid. So I just got a shim and ran a regular dropper in it, because it was just like, why even make that part?
Yeah.
Why not sell 31.6 with a shim and call that a 34.9 because you'll save 70 grams.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's, and it'll work better. You know, yep. It's just, oh.
Yeah,
so
I always wanted to try a 34.9 post, again, like what you're just saying, thinking it would be beefier, but in reality, the frame alignment was so hard to deal with that a lot of times we were just working with trying to get a 31.6 post in a frame, but relieving the inside of the seat tube lower so it wouldn't influence the seat post.
There you go. These are the new challenges. When you start talking about seat coat post clearance, people start having a lot more to say.
Yeah.
It's very cool. Anyway, I'm going to look up that Reamer manufacturer because that's what we need to know.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Devils and angels. What's your devil and what are your angels? Essentially, what do you suck at? What's your worst skill? What distracts you in a bad way? Why do you get fired? All that sort of stuff. Like, what are your failings?
I would say there's a couple parts to that question, but I'll start with I'm really bad at saying no. Uh-huh. I'll almost never turn down a project. And I'm trying to be a lot better now that I have a very happy wife, but I'm a hoarder of really heavy tools.
Hoarding's a bad thing.
Yeah. So I'll never say no to something. I mean, we've been walking around the driveway. We have seven cars.
You're going to fill this lot.
Yeah. Well, when we bought the house, the deed said that the driveway held 11 cars. And I said, perfect. That means we can get four more.
How about when it comes to work? Like, what's your worst skill? Like, I mean, just to throw it out there, not implying anything, being precise, or are you don't do math, or you leave bad finishes, or what kind of gets you when you're doing your work that you kind of go, damn it, I suck at this?
I would say sometimes being too passionate about something.
Sounds like a bad job interview. What are you worst at? I'm just too passionate.
Too passionate, that'll drive me into either oversimplification or being narrow-minded. I think that's a pretty real...
Explain the narrow-mindedness.
How
it affects you.
Kind of wanting control on a process or wanting to see start to finish because I want... Probably just because I want to see it finished in a way that I would finish it. Very critical. And not critical because I just want to pick things apart, but being critical because I know there's always room for improvement.
That's my perspective on criticism.
Yeah.
I mean, people dump on me. I can see it sometimes where it's like, Pete, say something positive for fucking once. But the thing is, yeah. It's like, I want to see continuous improvement. I do want to see, oh, this is great. Of course it's great. You did a thing, but let's get better.
So at my last job at the medical machine shop, I went through continuous improvement. We went through black belt, Kaizen training, Lean Six Sigma. I think I took some of that a little bit, not too seriously, like in a real world of Kaizen and Six Sigma, but of the continuous improvement, like never stop, but there is a point where you should like let it ride for a little bit because you're going to learn about the process and learn sure. what you actually need instead
yeah.
of like,
you can develop a new bike or fixture all you want, but then you go to use it and you find out everything you thought was important actually wasn't and other things are.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to just move forward sometimes
yep.
just to fucking actually do a thing.
Yeah, and if you're working at a company where you have a sellable product, at the end of the day, you have to sell product to be able to continue making product.
Okay, now, what are your angels? What do you think your superpower is? Why do you get the job done in a way that you stand out or that people talk about you when they're talking about something rad or some adventure or whatever? What makes you special?
It'll come full circle to the last question, never saying no. Always trying to figure it out, whether it's trying to learn how to do something or trying to be really good at something like racing bikes, trying to be good at wrenching on cars or dirt bikes or whatever, just never saying no to learning. And that's an angel because it gets you really far, but then it also brings you into the devils of like you take on too many tasks. You take on too much work. You always have projects because you're like, oh, I can do that. I can do that.
Right. I think my thing is I've defined what I'm willing to bust my ass for and continually improve and work at. And so much of everything else just falls by the wayside. Yeah. And it's like, I'm fat and slow. Fuck it. But I'm focusing more on this tool.
Yeah. So you were upstairs of the house that we live in now. You saw the kitchen.
Right.
Steph and I did that whole kitchen.
It looks nice.
But we know where to stop, and we've got a real good tile guy.
Right, right.
It's one of those tasks that I don't want to do. But our buddy, we ride bikes with him a ton, and he's a great tile guy. So like, oh, this is the perfect job for you.
Cool, yeah. All right, cool. I was thinking about that in the drive home, and I was like, oh, I gotta ask those questions because those are good questions to ask.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have some superpower, and we all have some devil that's dragging us down. And it's like, it's hard for other people to understand that, you know, it's like...
Let me bring that back to you. What's your devil?
Oh, God. Oh, my devil, I mean, let me, I'm not the answering questions mode right now. Okay, I'll get to it. Here we go. I'm old, I'm 53, and when I was young, kids like me were just called spazzes or rubbers or like... We were the problem kids, you know, we were distracting. We were a problem for any teacher that had us in the class because we either weren't paying attention or we were being disruptive. Basically, ADHD. It's just, we didn't call it that then.
Yeah.
We just got beat up.
Yeah.
Right? And that led to problems that weren't very good for a long time. And I ended up becoming... I was a slow starter, a slow developer.
Mm-hmm.
A late bloomer.
Yeah.
Right?
Got it. Yeah.
So it's like timing is everything. And they say, especially for success in the way the modern world runs, it really rewards people that develop earlier, not develop the best.
Right.
So it's whether you developed at the critical time in high school that got you into the fancy college, that got you that fancy job, that now you're successful in lots of ways, and you got rewarded for it. But you may not have topped out very well. You might actually end up being kind of fairly average or dumb. But the thing is, you developed early, and that's what gave you... I think Malcolm Gladwell talks about that in Outliers.
Okay.
But so anyway, I was
but
convinced...
But you might also develop early and go in the wrong direction to where you spent 30 years figuring out what you didn't want to do. And now is your time to thrive.
It could be, but I mean, my thing, in lots of ways, I discovered how left out of the system I was. And that I believed I wasn't one of the smart kids. And later on, I discovered what really was the problem was my late development and the institutions and advice systems around me, that the adults essentially didn't actually know what they were talking about.
Right.
And I kind of developed the Don Quixote complex, where I could be accused of tilting at windmills and taking on wars against power systems.
Yeah.
And that's a real problem in my world, is that I'm willing to do battle with the great and powerful.
Yeah.
Knowing that I will be losing, right? And for sometimes...
Hey, you gotta stand your ground.
Right. Well, dude, I'm there. I've got balls, and I'll do it. But the thing is, that can be productive or unproductive.
Yeah.
And personally, it's generally unproductive. And it doesn't get you very far.
I think that's my favorite thing about you. when there's a comment section on the internet with Peter involved, most people don't know that you know you're full of shit, but the way that you type it out on the internet people don't realize that. And that's when I like to come in and give you shit back.
You know, it's just tricky. It's internet comment sections are just, I think it's just easy to beat up on the little kids.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, come correct.
Yeah.
Like, if you came in there, you'd be coming with some real shit. If Brad Bingham came in with some real shit. But some doobie that's been to a bike store a couple times, mm-hmm. like, just shut up, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're just repeating shit you've heard. That's different, right? Okay, but then also, I work really slow. I'm also really clumsy.
Yeah.
I drop fucking everything. I'm so bad when it comes to dropping.
Yeah.
But I work slow, I think. And I will get great results in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But it's slow and it's hard earned.
We're in a production frame building shop for, I mean, you
well,
did,
I had.
You did it really
I
hard,
did. No, I can do production work, you know. Like, production work is different from the real thinking man's type of work, where you have to like think and move fast and do good work and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's kind of lends itself. It's like, I wasn't a real athlete.
Yeah.
That's a devil. Cause I've always loved bicycles, motorcycles, and skateboards. Now that's a fascination with tilt steer and the rider being a, integral part of the handling system of those vehicles.
Correct.
And I love that. And I think that's really great. I'm an adrenaline addict type of thing. But I don't have the skills to pay the bills, right? So the thing is, it's like I was always a marginal to bad skateboarder or a marginal to bad motorcycle or bicycle rider.
Yeah.
I just worked really hard. And here's one of the good things about me. I'm built like a brick shit house. And when I could mess up and hit a tree, I'm back riding after that.
Yeah.
I could take an incredible amount of abuse, failing over and over again until I figured it out.
Right.
So I didn't get to the level of being able to ride expert mountain biking riding or whatever like that because I had good muscles or fitness or anything like that. It was just the fact that I could fail horrifically over and over again and eventually figure it out.
That's called being hard-headed.
Oh, totally. I'm totally hard-headed land. But like a lightweight roadie that can throw down power, they have sick power to weight, and they can like go up any hill.
Mm-hmm.
They hit a tree once, they've retired for life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's that kind of thing where you see people that
be able to bounce back.
They can't hit things. But the thing is, it's like never being able to, no matter how much work I put in, I was never going to become known as a talented rider or whatever.
Yeah.
I just show up and do it. But I have fun.
Yeah.
I'm addicted to all that. And then,
what would you consider being an angel?
Oh, I mean, I could go on about my devils. That's right. What I was thinking. I was going to go into a big list. My angel. And this is like that thing where most things have a devil and angel part of it.
Yeah,
like,
we all know your shit doesn't stink, but what's your number one?
Well, my shit stinks. I call myself out on my welding all the time. Like, I don't think I've ever talked to somebody where I didn't acknowledge that I can't weld.
Right.
Okay, so my shit stinks. There's things I do bad.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like there's other things I hope I do better than other people.
Yeah.
And I get locked into problems. It's kind of like that weird ADHD thing or whatever,
mm-hmm.
where you can't focus on anything and you're kind of all over the place and you kind of get bored easy and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But later in life, or if you've been successful with that model and you've developed coping mechanisms and stuff, you actually can focus in on things very deeply.
Yeah.
And stay on task for very long times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that weird, I don't know how it works. I'm not an expert on all that stuff. But like working out the math, you should see the math I do to solve all these problems. And it's like, there was a math problem during COVID. I think I spent a week working on a math problem.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, I'll stick with it because I'm like, this is not right. And the numbers aren't right. And I want to get the numbers right because the numbers have to be right.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's a devil. Because like, you don't get productive that way. You don't move on. You don't get done. But what happened was I actually started to be able to use that. Because I did that, I was able to start seeing through the numbers and start realizing, oh, wait, those aren't driving parameters. These are driving parameters.
Yeah.
Because that's how the math works or whatever. And focusing in on my drawing and things like that. And I think that's a big one. And another angel, I think, is I've been around, you know, I work around a lot. I'm at a university and I work around fancy professors and everything like that. A lot of those people, now there's some really good ones, but a lot of them, they're just professional students.
Yeah.
They've just always gone to school. They were good at school and now they're in a school.
Yep.
And it's like, they're not exceptionally smart, a lot of them. They're just, they did all the things that it took to get a professorship or whatever, but like, they're actually not smart.
Yeah.
It's a system, anyone can get a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
They just have to
do the hoops right,
you know? And it's not that like someone asked me the other day, I made a comment about master's degrees and it was like, I dissed the reason why most people get master's degrees nowadays. And someone says, well, do you have a master's degree? And my comment was simple. I've never needed to get one.
Yeah.
It's like, why would I need to get a master's degree? Yeah. Why would I do that? I'm busy.
Yeah.
I'm fucking busy, bro.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think? I'm not fucking doing enough here?
Yeah.
You know, it is that kind of thinking where it's like, and that gets into, I mean, I guess that's the truth about devils and angels is that they bounce back and forth. That devil of being a late bloomer and realizing that you got bad guidance and you were in a fucked up situation that tracked you bad and the adults around you were fucking morons. That the world's telling you to do things in a certain way. But, you know, you kind of have to stand your ground and you have to kind of go like, no, I'm gonna do battle with the giant when all other people see is windmills.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I think I've been we have the parents we have the wealth or class level that we were born into.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people don't have to earn any money at all. Some people have to be partially employed. Some people have to work their ass off just to get by and luck of the draw.
Yep.
And then it's what you do with it. Right. Like Kate Courtney. It's like perfect example. It's like, dude, she's fucking born fucking crazy rich.
Yeah.
Like town Ross next to me, one of the wealthiest areas in the area, super rich. But she got into Stanford. She got a fucking real degree from Stanford.
Yeah.
While being one of the top mountain bike racers in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, in 1 year, she was the top
right.
one. You know,
right.
I mean, no fucking slouch. Like, yeah. And it's like, you know, anybody can be given good opportunities or bad opportunities and fuck it all up. Like, how many rich kids become drug addicts? And just losers.
Yeah.
Plenty of them. Because it's too easy to do. Anyway, when it comes to angels, it's like, I'm on a holy war.
Yeah.
Right? Why did I drive here to talk to you? I've been talking to you for fucking 3.5 hours or something like that now. And it's like, and you're probably the same way. It's like, are you on a holy war or not? And it's like, are you marching off to victory every day? And it's like, yeah, at the end of the day, you're fucking beaten.
Yeah.
But you wake up the next day to go to war.
Yep.
And it's like, hopefully you know a lot of other people like that. Because these are the cool people. You know? And it's like, yeah, you don't have to be a winner. It's like, yeah, you're a pro racer. You get to win races. You get to stand on the box. I don't get to do that. Cool. That's cool guy shit.
Mm-hmm.
The cool guys love that shit. But there's a lot of other cool guys that you know to call this bro. Because that bro shows up.
Yep.
They're going to show up always.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to bring it, you know? And it's like, those people are the shit in life. And it's like, the more of those people you have around you, and I want to be one of those people. And you know when you're beating yourself up and you're like, I didn't show up, or I was a coward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being a coward, oh my God. Like, that's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
And we're cowards in ways that aren't like fighting people or going to war or whatever. Coward is like not speaking truth to power.
Right.
Coward is you didn't back up a friend when all the guys in the shop were joking around about somebody who you think's cool and they think is a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't back them up or,
yeah.
or her up or whatever. And it's like those situations are the shit that drive me fucking insane.
Yeah.
And it's like I'll kill myself. It's like, oh my God, I didn't back up. I didn't back my bro up or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. Oh my God, it's the worst.
I mean, a lot of those friends are the friends that will actually show up. The ones that were the coward or, you know, they're the real people. And sometimes being a coward or, you know, sometimes that's important. Like sometimes you have to have some fear or...
You have to kiss the emperor's ring.
Yeah.
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 I mean, there's times. I get it. And then we all have rationalizations or perfectly good reasons for that kind of stuff. But I don't think you get to where you're trying to get to. And especially with all the hard work and showing up that you obviously do, without recognizing that there's more to this world than making money and accumulating lame status. You know, it's all that status game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, there's different types of status that's out here. And it's like, even if it's just for you and you're giving yourself the status at the end of your days, you know, if you can be like, I fucking respect myself.
Mm-hmm. If you can, finding wins like anywhere, like, are important. Like having
or the right times or losing. Like I joke that some people don't know how to lose.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's ways of losing.
Yeah.
It's like you can lose on your fucking knees groveling, or you can lose on your feet. Which do you want to do?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like,
yeah,
it's like, if I know I'm going to lose, and this gets into the Don Quixote thing, if I know I'm going to lose, why not make a fucking spectacle of it?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
why turn my loss into their win?
Mm-hmm.
If I have to lose, why not make sure they lose too?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And that's a good thing, but it's also a bad thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it feels so mealy-mouthed to like to bounce back and forth on that. Like you just did it too. It's like,
yep.
And it's like, I mean, I could go on about like what are the devils and what are the angels if I'm better prepared. I mean, obviously I'm catching you off guard. But those are important things to recognize. I mean, people think my shit don't stink. Or if I project that. And it's like, I don't want to project that my shit don't stink. Like that is not my intention.
Mm-hmm.
I may at times, like back in the old days of message boards, be the heel.
Yeah.
Like being a heel is a different thing. Like sometimes to be the heel, you're contributing to the show. And somebody has, because there's a lot of groupthink that goes on and people pat themselves on the back. And it's like, you know, okay, how's this one? I was working with the motorcycles and racetrack shit. And it's like with motorcycles, you get on a message board back then. It's like, what's the tire to run? It's like, oh, the cool guys are running these tires at the racetrack. Like, this guy's winning races and he's running that tire and all that shit. And it's like, well, you know, that doesn't mean that tire is rad.
Yeah.
That winning racer's on it.
Yeah.
It's like why does Greg
Menar
or name a top famous paid racer.
Yeah.
Like, why do they get paid $250,000 a year? It's because they can ride the worst fucking bike in the world faster than anybody.
Yep.
Because you don't pay them a lot of money if your bike's awesome. You pay them a lot of money because your bike sucks and they're going to make it go fast.
Right.
That's the actual truth of it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like, and someone's got to say that when you're having a discussion. And the thing is, that's not the discussion bros want to have.
Yeah.
Like you probably get along. That's a devil. Bro culture. I can't do it, man. That fucking is bullshit.
Yeah.
I can't fucking stand bro culture. But in bicycling, bro culture rules bike culture.
Yeah.
And if you can't bro or belong in a group of bros, you're fucking going nowhere. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't do that. I can't fucking stand that. It's not my bag.
Yeah. I mean, I've been at a race that I did really well at, in the pro class, smaller race, but pro class. And there was a national level rider there that after the race, when I was on the podium with him, somebody heard him say, who is that guy on that janky aluminum bike?
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, I built that bike.
Yeah.
Like, what'd you do? What did you do?
Right.
You just showed up.
Right.
Like,
you know how to ride a bike.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like,
I did twice as much work as you because not only did I train to be fast, I don't really train, but I mean, I guess I didn't let off the brakes so I could go fast and had the skill to support it. But I also tried to figure out how to make this bike better for customers.
Sure.
And I showed up to the same place as you.
Right.
And it's just like, that's just me.
Right.
I am the guy on the hopefully no longer janky aluminum bike. But
sure. Yeah. You're on like, oh, that's Adam. He's a sick guy. I mean, how's the thing? It's like my handlebars. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much heat do I have I taken for how many years on that shit? Like, my handlebars? Oh, my God. Like, the set it on fire comment. That's, like, the best one ever. It's, like, set it on fire. And it's, like, every bro that knows exactly what they're talking about but actually doesn't says I'm doing it wrong, that they're bad and everything. And it's, like, well, have you tested? Do you know?
Yeah.
How do you know? And all that sort of stuff. And it's, like... Like you were saying about winning a race on the bike you built and designed. It's like, I mean, I've taken huge risks with what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Monetarily, spending the money, time-wise, doing all the work and everything to get there. And then had real successes that nobody else can validate.
Yeah.
Because they're not... Maybe, no one's willing to copy it.
And maybe real successes that nobody else will ever see.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be. And then, I mean, you talk about the Pete shit don't stink comment. How many other people do you know that do full blog posts about their bike breaking in two? Or going to the hospital on the shit that they designed? Or like, oh, look, is this a failed weld? Like, I did a post just recently, my first weld failure.
No, I mean, you do a great job of actually doing a kind of scientific process of, like, looking at, you have the hype on the design, you do the process, and then you look back at it and try to figure out why the process didn't work.
Well, you're saying being critical, constant improvement.
Yeah.
It's like, I think
my favorite one was we were talking about this earlier on, like, at the last minute, you make a change, and like you probably know what I'm talking about, but you had one of your first 3D prints with the stars.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like,
I have an explanation for that.
Number one engineering mistake is making sharp corners in a part.
And I made 5 sharp corners times 6.
Yeah. There's also a lot
to be fair, that one failure is a different one, and I should probably write about that failure.
Yeah.
Because that's a special failure.
Yeah.
Okay, we talk about overthinking and getting too deep in it and everything like that. So I try to optimize and try to look at as much as I possibly can. Am I using every engineering tool at my disposal? Within my head.
Yeah.
I don't do a lot of fucking FEA and all that crap. And it's just like, is this real or is this bullshit? Mm-hmm. Am I pretending I'm doing good work or is this really good work?
Yeah.
And I try to go through that before I make anything. It's like, is this the best I can show up with right now? And that becomes problematic. When like you're about to print a set of 3D prints for a bike.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh yeah, I just have to work on this one thing. And then you look up and it's 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
And you're still...
Or 2 a.m.
but it's just like, it's going too far. And it's like, you do have to do something eventually.
Yeah. There's a good, not a great saying, but there's a saying, fail fast, fail often, or at least fail cheap.
Yeah.
You know,
fail cheap and often.
And that is something that I've tried to do, even with like buying equipment, mm-hmm. like trying to figure out what's going to work best for my situation, because this world that we live in, we do a lot of different things, and one certain thing that you spend a lot of money for may not be exactly what you need.
Right.
And you can just use it different ways or iterate in different ways, like with fixturing, try a really cheap fixture, figure out what's wrong, and then go to the next fixture or redesign. Then you can start to focus on what actually matters, especially with welding. Like, you try to throw a lot of stuff at welding or making really nice fixtures to make a straight part. But then you realize at the end of the day, part's not going to be straight no matter what kind of fixture you make, unless you record your results after welding. Eric Barr kind of really brought this to light of like, weld a bike and get data of how it moved. Record that data and then do it again.
Did you hear me talk to Brad Bingham about his process?
A little bit. I think I only listened to like half of that.
Dude, he's got fixture adjustments for his process and weld calibration where he throws his fixture off in certain ways.
Totally.
So that when it's done welding, So in that case, he's not fighting the weld.
Yeah.
He's working with the weld.
Yeah. I've got friends that worked for, QuickTime? No. I don't know why I'm not remembering it right now, but they make like race car rear axles and like for like 4x4s and everything, and they weld them out of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
So they plan for them to be straight based on results that they've found with welding a rear axle. You have a ton of weld and you need a really straight part. So you just figure out how it's going to distort and then fixture it distorted. So mm-hmm. when it's done being welded, it's straight.
Because I would love to start thinking that way more.
There's only so many ways to symmetrically weld a bike that looks good and that is correct to the process. You don't really want to like a down tube weld on a bottom bracket shell. You don't really want to do it in like four separate welds. But if you can do it, if you can lay in a nice hot weld symmetrically on both sides, great. But you need to plan for what's going to happen.
Sure.
Is the seat tube going to come out of alignment when you put that big weld in? Is the bottom bracket going to turn into a potato chip? Because all of them do. A whole other topic with bottom bracket shells. But
look at my pillar on my fixture.
Yeah. Yeah. No bottom. You can't align bikes off the bottom bracket shell because it turns into a potato chip after you weld it.
Well, I just referenced both sides.
Yeah.
On my fixture. And it's... I mean, a lot of that came because my last bikes that used to route internally for the dropper, mm-hmm. which I don't anymore.
Yeah.
Basically, anything of the bottom bracket you couldn't see had been removed.
Yeah.
So when it distorted, that thing was distorting all over the place.
Oh, right, because you had like a big slot in the top, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you could go seat tube to
down tube. Right, right. Yep. So the thing is, it's like, think of the distortion.
Yeah.
It's fucking crazy. And it's like, I don't weld that way, but the thing is, it informed my fixture design. Yeah. Oh, to finish that thing with the stars. Just want it forgotten. So, because I go so deep, and I get lost in how deep I go,
mm-hmm.
of trying to do it just perfect, as was perfect
that
as
a,
I can.
Was that a bonded?
Yeah.
Yeah, carbon bonded. Yep.
Right. Anyway, so that was like, I just needed to relax and stop thinking about everything being perfect.
Yeah.
And just like, what do I want in this? Oh, wouldn't it be cool if we just did star cutouts? It's like, well, fuck it. Let's just do star cutouts.
Yeah.
And what that was is like, just let go. Yeah. Just let go. Hold, like bite your
step
teeth.
Step back from the computer.
Step back. Just like, isn't this going to be fun? Like all that sort of thing. And it's like, no, of course it broke.
Yeah.
And I mean, so a couple lessons got learned there. There's such a thing called stress risers, and they exist.
Yeah.
and five-pointed sheriff stars, because that's my logo is sheriff star, because they're chasing me, are very big stress risers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you don't need to cut out material right in a handlebar type of thing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like I was trying to just fucking chill and not fucking think of optimizing every little thing. But... Oh God, I totally lost where I was trying to go next on that. Oh, you were talking about the welding distortion and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh. Anyway, maybe we've just been talking too much. Anyway, the welding distortion stuff is crazy. And Brad Bingham was talking a lot about that, about pre-throwing his fixture out.
Yeah.
Which is really cool because he's really stickler about perfection in his bike builds.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. I'm a terrible welder, like I've been saying. Oh, about my shit don't stink. I mean, the thing is that... Like, it's not cool in fabrication land to do bad work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, how many weld shops have you been into where it's really cool to throw down a shitty weld bead? Or how many machine shops has it been cool to, like, make parts out of tolerance? Yeah. Or has it been cool to, like, show up drunk to a meeting and not know what we're talking about or whatever like that?
Yeah.
It's not. It's like having your showing up and representing is what we're supposed to be striving for. We're supposed to be trying to come correct.
Yep.
And it's very this high school cool thing of like, I don't care. I'm not trying to do good. It's like, well, I am. How about this? I take bikes seriously.
Yeah.
Do you? Well, show it. I mean, like when I see somebody with a bike with a lousy print, or not just lousy, but just not meaningful on a real level.
Yeah.
And it's like, fix your print.
Yeah.
Why not fix your print? And it's like, oh, how can you say that? You know, they did a print. It's like, yeah, but it's bad.
Yeah.
It's not, like, you got to show up. That's like, basically, he threw down some popcorn where you're supposed to weld it properly,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's like, when do we say that? And it's like, yeah, I have the heel persona on some message boards for that stuff. And it got really old, the message board stuff. And I backed away from message boards.
Yeah.
Because it was just like, you know, at first it was like, maybe we can step up our game and we can move the discussion forward and we can start talking at a higher level than this bullshit. And that just kind of never happened. It was kind of like, fuck this. I'm just going to speak my shit on my blog and you can read it and appreciate it, whatever. Yeah. And, but the thing is, it's like, you think I'm wrong? Prove it. Prove I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I'm down.
Right.
Like, you call me out on shit. Like, the people that I respect and work with and talk to about problems call me out on my shit. And they say, no, you're wrong. You can't do that or whatever. And it's like, if I'm saying something on my, like say I do a post on some topic and I'm wrong, well, somebody else should write a blog post about how Pete was wrong. Yeah. And show that I was wrong.
Show the data.
Yeah, show that the shit that is so disagreeable that Pete thinks he's so right, show I'm wrong. And it's like, but nobody ever steps up.
Yeah.
Nobody ever does that. And it's like, so your criticism of me is that I showed up, took this shit seriously, and threw down.
Yeah.
That's a problem for you.
It's not the criticism of being right or wrong. It's just that...
The tone.
It's just they don't have the experience to know why you said that.
Oh, yeah. There's that. And there's a huge amount of that.
Yeah.
Especially in bicycling.
Yeah.
I mean...
They haven't failed so many fucking times...
Oh, my God.
...that they're like, oh, Peter's in the weeds because... Peter's been through it.
Well, that's the thing. It's like we just looked at your fixturing for those parts.
Yeah.
And you're paying $50 for those expanding posts and some pins and your whole system there and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It costs money.
Yeah.
But, well, why are you spending that money? Why are you making that investment? Well, it's so that the machine can have these offsets and these coordinate systems and this reproduces and is repeatable and everything like that.
Yeah.
It's like if you're in metal fabrication land, well, not metal, machine shop land, you're trying for reproducible results every time and predictive results.
Yep.
Like you want to, you don't want to just, like when I talk about bikes, like the famous example, Pete, look, new bike comes out. Pete says, that's shit. And then people say, how do you know you've never ridden it? It's like, because I looked at the geometry sheet. It's obviously total garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you see that?
Right.
And they can't.
Yeah.
That's the difference. When I look at the geometry, it's like, oh, this is a completely clapped out piece of crap.
Yeah.
And they look at it and they see it's red. Yeah. Well, there's a big difference between those two ways of looking at it.
Yep.
And what did it take to get to the point where I stop noticing it's red and start noticing that you can't run anything but 100 millimeter dropper if you're even remotely trying to go fast on that thing.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, then we get into, okay, well, I've got 20 years just a blog. I'm not trying to do a defense piece here, but,
Amazon.
I mean, like if you're a kid in the bike shop, and I'd love to be an example for a kid in a bike shop. There he goes. You know, we were talking earlier, I was mentioning earlier about adults being bad examples or giving bad advice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what if they see what I do and say, oh, that's how you're supposed to do it? Like, what if they saw the work that you do in there, but it was documented online and describe what you do?
Yeah.
And some kid that's working in a bike shop says, oh, you know that 45-year-old mechanic I'm working next to that stinks of alcohol every morning? maybe he doesn't know anything about bikes. And that's why he's a 45-year-old mechanic, you know, working next to a 16-year-old.
Yep.
Maybe this other person does, and that what they're doing or what how they're looking at it is a better way. And we need to show that somehow. And we have social mechanisms that we've always used in the past, like shame, guilt,
yeah,
embarrassment, all these like quote unquote negative feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, you should be ashamed. That's a shitty drawing. Why are you showing the internet your shitty drawing?
Yeah.
And if someone, and if you produce your best work and someone says your drawing is not good, you should be like, tell me why, so I can make that better.
Yeah.
Rather than, fuck you, you don't know what you're talking about. That's a great drawing. How do I know? Because I drew it.
Right.
Well, bro, I was 12 once too.
Yeah.
But that logic doesn't work much past 12. Like, you know your shit's tight when you're sitting at a meeting talking about some design shit and your shit's on point.
Yep.
You got all your shit backed up.
Yep.
How's this? I showed up here with updated models from the model I showed you last night because I saw the error that hopefully you saw in that model that should be obvious. But I fixed that and also improved that model a few times so that when I showed up here, if we opened up my model and looked at it,
yeah,
my shit was more on point than it was at 6 p.m. last night.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to come correct as best and as good as I always can in this sphere.
So, speaking about your model, I'm a simple man, and I clicked the exploded view button.
Oh no! It must have blown up hard.
No.
Because I haven't adjusted.
I was actually very impressed. I clicked the exploded view and immediately got overwhelmed.
Oh really?
There's so many parts, but I figured it out and.
Hopefully you notice how many similar parts they were.
Yeah, no, I was really impressed. It's, everybody has a different way of thinking about things. And I think the way that we think about a fixture, can be very inverse of each other. Of you're trying to create a fixture that's modular and adaptable to any environment. Where I'm a little space constrained, but
my fixture also makes better use of your space than any of the tools you have.
Yeah, also, just the ability to use one thing for what it's really good at.
Right. You want to have a dedicated tool. That's what that does.
And the setup and teardown is where I see. So like, mm-hmm. I have production background.
That's when you
so
get
like,
another plate.
Like one thing when I helped Joe, like I got one of the first Cobra fixtures and I told him I was going to be very critical.
Good.
And be very upfront. And I was like, I'm going to have more frames through this in a week than any of your current customers will have in a year.
I'm sure that was true.
I wasn't trying to brag.
You were explaining how the situation was going to go down.
I was like, we're no Moots, but Moots also wasn't probably buying a Cobra fixture.
Right.
Like at that time. But I was like, I want something that can be very specific, but also move around very quickly.
Right.
And so that's where my headspace is at, looking at your fixture without having my actual hands on it. And,
mine's very much a tool room fixture.
Correct.
Yeah.
And without having, honestly, without spending like a week with you in front of a computer and understanding your design principles, I only understand it 75%.
Right.
Whereas...
And you know what's interesting also is like that idea is very good about understanding the mode and the way people are coming at things,
mm-hmm.
because I had never seen a fixture like this until I made one and have only found one example in the world that you could say this is derived from. But of course, it was after I made it, so
yeah.
I feel good about that.
Yeah.
But the thing is that fixturable breadboard that is used in the fabrication space, I always sort of struggle to call it what it is.
Yeah.
Because like it's a welding table, but welding tables aren't fixturable. It's like it's a fixturable welding table. Anyway, but
table with holes.
Table with holes. But the way that it's generally done in the modern space with that taper at the top and everything like that, the things that make it really work, the way Siegman and BuildPro do it. So I knew that fabricators used those, but I never worked in a space that had one or talked about them. Certainly nobody in bicycling ever talked about them.
Yeah.
And I got into that just because I needed space in the shop for a welding table. And it's like, well, how can I use that welding table for other things? And then I adapt my frame fixture to that. And I was still using optical breadboard for tooling and on some stuff. Then I said, oh, wait, this is 16 millimeter steel. Like, this stuff is pretty accurate. This can work for machining and all these cross uses.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start taking a dive into an ecosystem. It's sort of like you don't see how much I'm leveraging in that design. Maybe, totally fair, it doesn't work with your way of working. That could totally be a thing. But also, if you've never worked in an environment where one of these tables was leveraged in a very creative and the way I've been using it.
Correct. Yeah.
And learning how to use it, because I've looked at a lot of pictures over the preceding years, the years since.
Yeah.
Of other fixturing setups on these tables and ways of solving problems using these tables. And I would definitely say the stuff I'm starting to do maybe in the last year on these tables is different than anybody else, even in fabrication land.
Yeah.
And what I'm leveraging on these, and that it allows certain things to happen. And like I see pro bicycle, like a pro fab place,
mm-hmm.
making a motorcycle or bicycle chassis, laying out a bicycle or a motorcycle vertically on one of these tables because they don't know how to use the table.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way they're going to measure angles.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I solved that problem. But there's other problems too. I've actually made a sine bar platform that works on these tables.
Yeah.
That bolts directly to the table as a sine bar is used.
Yeah.
So that you can use an angle from the table and all that stuff. And if you look at what was done with the Whopper fixture. But more when, like, say, the new fixture, once I write my blog post on it and show it off.
Yeah.
Most of the money you spend on that can be used in so many other ways. It can be used for a setup, like for you make a setup and you can bring it over to your mill and cut the part the way it's held for welding and then bring it back to the weld table, bolt it right into the whole assembly and weld into it and do all these cross purposes. And this gets into space and money. So you don't need an alignment table because the weld table works perfectly fine for that.
Yeah.
It works as a frame fixture.
Yeah.
It also works as a welding table. And if you have it on a rotisserie, you can tilt it up and tuck it out of the way.
Yeah.
You can fixture other things on it, like bed frames and staircase shit or whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
You can use for that. It can be a smaller table or a bigger table. But when you spend the money, you're getting it in other places. You now have the ability to attach 80-20 directly to your welding table in a precise way.
Mm-hmm.
You have a linear rail on your welding table that you can slide things into position, not just the other things. You have the tube pins, like the head tube pin.
Yeah.
That's the same diameter as the table pin. So if you want to work on just a head tube assembly, you can just put the pin flat on the table and work with it that way. You want to hold a separate sub-assembly. It's designed so that you can just bolt it right up to the table, not even in the frame fixture. So as many parts as possible will then go into that table.
Yeah.
And everything just starts bolting up. It just becomes Legos. So when you talk about a frame fixture, It's like, great, you've got a frame fixture. You spend $6,000, $5,000 or whatever it costs for a frame fixture. And that's all it does. Yeah. And the minute you try to do anything else with it, it's useless. That, to me, is a waste.
Yeah.
And when you talk about you want to use the thing, well, how's this? You have the most rigid frame fixture. Like, you've got that Cobra fixture there. It's perfectly nice and everything like that. But it doesn't match the rigidity of this fixture.
Right.
Like, this thing is rigid.
Yep.
Like, and it's precise and all that. You can argue tolerance stack.
Do you finish weld in that?
No, I try to tack as much as I can.
Yeah.
And my table is 140 millimeters right now. The way the Cyberdyne was built.
The like standoff distance.
Yeah, standoff from the table. Yeah. And this one's 180.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering if I should go to 200. Kind of in that range where
yeah.
It's like, when do you get gains and when does it start working against you?
In my opinion...
You just tack.
Like I said, I'm a very simple man. And I know they're just bicycles at the end of the day. So I do very minimal tacking.
Uh-huh.
But especially with the use of laser cut tubes, I've started to learn that I could trust the miters and my welding technique, that I didn't, the fixture didn't necessarily need to be rigid if I wasn't forcing anything.
Mm-hmm.
If things went into place and they tacked nicely, you know, then you could really baby it. But there's a lot of things with Joe that like, he had some like, nylon T-nuts or Delrin T-nuts. And it was really just like, the type of manufacturing where he was very early on, he was threading the T-nuts.
Sure.
And that didn't work because he'd rip the threads out of the T-nuts. But now he uses them as a stud. So you're going to pull up against a hard shoulder. And it's just those little things of like, yeah, Joe, sometimes we over tighten the shit out of stuff. And that's just what happens when you're in a fast paced machine shop. Mm-hmm. Like if you spent your entire life savings on the fixture, you might treat it a little bit better.
Sure.
I actually, every time I buy something from Joe, I always tell him to give me the seconds Anno because I was like, I don't care what it looks like.
First thing, you're going to bump a grinder up against it.
I'm going to use the shit out of it.
Sure, sure.
I'm going to scratch it the first time I use it.
Oh, yeah. That's a very important thing with that. I just have been learning. I mean, we both have been learning.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my work lately has been, in terms of engineering, thinking about much further downstream.
Yeah.
Much further in terms of cross-using everything. In that, like, I don't have a CNC machine. And like, a lot of things are developed around my limitations. I have beat machine tools.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of, like, fancy anything there. If I need to buy a special cutter, it's coming out of my pocket,
yeah,
right? And it's not being paid for by a customer or anything like that. It's mm-hmm. straight up, this goes to feed the beast.
Yeah.
And so also I'm lazy as fuck. See, that's the thing. I think you're a hard worker. Like Don.
I think we have a good,
Don Ferris, all that boy wanted to do was work.
Yeah.
And Mark Norstad, those guys work. And it's like, it's a great way to success.
Yeah.
People that bust their ass and work constantly generally succeed.
Yeah.
It's a great lesson to learn.
Yeah.
Bust your ass.
Good example is I paid less for my CNC machine than what your fixture table would cost.
Right.
But that means I'm going to work twice as hard to run that CNC machine to make parts. It's we're getting places in a very different way.
Sure.
And maybe that's why, I mean, that's why we have differing opinions on how we get there.
Sure.
Which I think is good. Like,
oh yeah.
That's why everything
we learn
iterates so well and works together.
But I am very lazy. I'm yeah. so lazy.
Yeah.
Like, dude, I don't want to build bikes. I hate building bikes.
Yep.
I want to have the very best bicycle I can be on.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves me to be the one to design it.
Yep.
And I like being right.
Yeah.
I mean, being right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And it's like, you know, if liking being right forces you to step up your game, play better,
yeah,
work hard in the right ways, then sure, I'll do that so that I can be right. But I prefer to just sit on the couch and eat ice cream. Yeah. That is that's my happy place right there.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, like, when it comes to like I've put more, like, how's this? This is the fourth fixed bicycle frame fixture I've engineered in as many years.
Yeah.
Or less, or whatever it is. And I mean, name anybody that you know that has designed four frame fixtures. Now, Jeff at Sputnik, he has probably done two. I can't speak for him, but largely his Sputnik is an evolution or a constant improvement of what he's had.
Yeah.
I know that he's improved it and everything like that, but it's kind of like it's that fixture. And if you look at Cobra, it's like, yeah, he made one, but then he's been constantly refining. It's that.
Yeah.
And like in large part, the three that I did prior to this were different fixtures that used a fixturing table.
Mm-hmm.
And this fourth one is combining all the things about those into one masterwork.
Take all of the best things that you learned from the original ones, but make it to where somebody like a frugal person like me could actually see the value in investing into a design like that without, because like,
and it's right now.
Yeah.
Like the Cyberdyne had problems.
Yeah.
The first Skynet was designed to be super cheap and easy to make.
Yeah.
And the Whopper, lousy to set up.
Yeah.
But cool. It did solve the problem in a whole different way. And this is just like, okay, let's take all of this together.
Because I would say probably you were like one of your fixtures, maybe the Cyberdyne, was probably in the $10,000 realm of like, if you were to
buy it retail.
Yeah.
Well, I made it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it probably cost you without having, you have machine shop friends, like you didn't farm it out to a going rate machine shop probably. You paid for it.
Well, I made all the cylindrical parts myself.
Yeah.
The machined parts were done by a friend. I mean, I gave him a Firefly bicycle.
Yeah. he was getting paid.
He was getting paid.
But, you know, it's...
sure.
From what I see, from outside looking in, you went through a bunch of different designs to essentially have a $10,000 marketable product to probably with... I mean, based on the 20 minutes I looked at it last night, you're probably now into like a $6,000 marketable product, which... I'm
thinking it's less than that.
Yeah. Well, looking at, you know, like the Build Pro table and plates, you'll have like $4,000.
I don't even count the table.
Because you can use it for so many different
things. Well, that's the thing. It's like, to me, this is like, of course you have one of these tables in your shop.
Yeah.
Because who the hell told you you should have a metal shop without one?
I mean, I've also
Because that's seen, crazy.
I've also seen a lot of those tables in shops, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing with one of those? You don't do any work.
Oh, that would need it.
That would need this table.
Sure.
Or like high-end people like on YouTube. I don't know if it's like paid promotion thing, but it's like, why do you even have that? You use it as a workbench.
You use it for as a backdrop to your YouTube videos.
I know that any flat surface is going to be used wrong.
Yes, like, it's going to be used to support cardboard boxes.
There's so many. working in the metrology world, it's funny seeing a granite surface plate dresser come in to a machine shop and dress or grind in surface plates.
This is not a temperature controlled environment.
They wear granite. Uh-huh. Granite's really soft.
Sure.
It's abrasive. So like it can get worn really easy. And when I was at that shop, I liked to talk to all those techs that came in.
Sure.
I was a tech. I worked with
But
a
you
lot
said
of
you had a
techs.
Problem with people coming in to do that.
No, sorry. I loved when they came in because I would get to talk to them.
Sure.
And then watch how things got used.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about how granites got used.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had one machinist, or he was a toolmaker machinist, and then he kind of, you know, became a carpet dweller. And he had a granite on his Kennedy. The first thing when you walked into his office, the corner that everybody would come into his office and set their coffee cup on was always low. And they would come in every 6 months and dress his table and like I kind of got a relationship with the granite guy.
Because it's getting worn by coffee.
And like you'd see him with the diamond dresser dressing on the table. And
awesome.
Looking at the, it looks like a telescope, but it's how to see the flatness across the granite surface plate. And he's like, no, come here, come over here and look at it.
You can see it.
You can see the low spot where somebody sets their hand every day.
Uh-huh.
That's how, I mean, granite's
sure.
actually pretty soft. Like
yeah.
everybody thinks it's great and they buy them at auctions and it's like, go buy one at an auction and then pay somebody $500 to come in and dress your table.
Right.
Because there's people that still do that.
Sure. Yeah.
And,
well, there has to be because how else are you going to get a calibration
system? Yeah, exactly.
You
so
know?
It's, yeah, it's funny. Like the flat surfaces thing is like right now you see in my shop, I actually, that my like weld shop garage, I moved that big table out of my CNC machine shop side and put a machine there.
Right.
Same footprint. But now I have this machine that's going to make money instead of having a surface that's going to collect shit.
Oh, sure. I mean, when it comes to like the weld table, if you're in crunch for space or like if you want a frame fixture, if you want an alignment table,
mm-hmm.
if you want a weld table,
yep.
have a small weld, fixable weld table
yep.
That you have mounted on a rotisserie so you can tilt it vertical
yeah.
and stuff it in the corner when you're not using it. Because for most people, like you're doing a dedicated machine shop. Most
yeah.
people in the bike world, if they're working in the garage, I'm not trying to say I'm targeting the DIY guy or whatever like that. But the thing is, space is a premium. I'm in the Bay Area. Like, dude, space,
yeah.
forget about it.
I can't
like,
even imagine.
Like that kind of thing. And it's like, even if you're in a rad shop and you do a run of bikes every month or whatever, you can move that shit out of the way and use that space productively in
mm-hmm.
the meantime.
Yep.
Like when you're paying $2 a foot or whatever it is now, $3 a foot or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like make use of all these things. So like, that's the thing. It's like, you don't just have a weld table that's like 8-inch thick steel that you picked up at the scrapyard and it doesn't move and it's solid as a rock. And it's like, yeah, but it just took over that whole corner of the shop. And the only thing it is a rest for when you're welding.
Yeah.
It's like, you can do 8 other things with that surface.
Yep.
You can use it for all kinds of things. I just see this as being an asset that in a lot of ways hasn't been discovered very well.
I mean, you're definitely going in the direction of like most frame fixtures in the past 15 years became obsolete.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Well, like
whether it's you're building a bike, like
I give the example
like
that
or...
I tried to build a bike and I had used up the anvil
yeah.
fixture.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't use it anymore.
Yep.
Right.
But, you know, when Don built it, there was no, I wouldn't say foresight, but Don knew that the people building bikes,
were building
buying his frame fixtures, were going to be building pretty simple bikes.
I don't think, I mean, I'll give Don all the credit in terms of like, there was no reason at the time
mm-hmm.
that he could have imagined.
Yeah. Well, tubes weren't long enough.
Yeah. Just nobody did that shit.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
it's like, and also what was I building? It's like a low head tube bike, which pushes things out even further, you
yeah.
know? Yeah. I mean, I'm not faulting anybody else, but also it's like, if you're a TIG welder, why are you buying a fixture that's designed for flame use or,
right. yeah.
or, you know, it's like, Or just also like when I describe the Cyberdyne, it's like if there exists almost no bike in the dirt space that uses a seat tube that is coincident to the bottom bracket,
mm-hmm.
why are you using a fixture that was designed around the coincidence of the seat post to the bottom bracket?
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then also it's like even if it was if it intersected proximately, why would the center of it be the target?
Yeah.
Right? And things like that. And I mean, we have to rethink things and repurpose and find new value. And I think what I'm trying to do with the fixture is find that there's all this value that even a lot of fab shops haven't seen.
Yeah.
That I like I've been challenged to find these uses. And it's like you've seen like the full boat advertisement for these fixturing tables
mm-hmm.
with the like the fixtures and the arms and the pillars and
yeah.
everything's being clamped all over the place. And it's like fundamentally some of those setups are really kind of lame or bad or yeah, that's great if you're Boeing and you just
you can just buy $10,000 more tooling for that one setup every day.
Yeah. I mean, there are some wild race car shops that you're like, you look at their fixture table and it's like, you have $100,000 in fixture table.
Yeah.
With a $100,000 car wrapped around it.
Right,
which,
right.
I mean, the table should always cost more than the part being produced.
Well.
But.
It's just the bike world, we have a way. You know that thing when you've been trying to solve a problem? And you've always seen it done this way. So that's the way you do it.
Right.
Until suddenly you realize there's a better way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can't help but see that it's totally, like, there's a better way. But especially with biking, bike building, because other industries like computer chip manufacturing or car manufacturing or name a manufacturing environment,
mm-hmm.
they are pressed for money. They want, real money is on the line.
Mm-hmm.
They hire real engineers to solve the problem so it's solved. And then they have to do it again and again and again.
Yeah.
And they get damn good at making what they make.
Yep.
Right? In the bike world, how many times do you hear this reference? Like with drawings. Oh, you can just draw that full scale on paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's terrible advice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know why? We don't live with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
You know, we've progressed since then, and there's a reason. Parametric mm-hmm. modeling crushes Boolean modeling.
Yeah.
Like, crushes it.
Yep.
Like, instantly. And, but the thing is, in this ecosystem of bicycles, like, people talking about stack and reach. It's like, why are you talking about stack and reach? That doesn't make sense. It makes no sense in the world if you're talking about high-performance bikes and trying to exact more performance, mm-hmm. that you'd be talking stack and reach.
Yeah.
That's crazy talk. Yet it is continually done.
Yeah.
Or top tube length. There's still people talking about, and these dinosaur ideas.
Or like, how about, so I don't get too in the weeds with like really discussing or like the problem with stack and reach, but my biggest pet peeve is bottom bracket height.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, well, what tires are you running?
Right.
It's like, you're that's not a real number. When you sit on the bike, your bottom bracket height is lower.
it's an argument for using drop.
Yeah.
You know, but if you notice on my drawings, because I design around two different tire sizes.
Yeah.
I have front wheel drop and rear wheel drop. You know, but I go by bottom bracket height. But the thing is, I'm fairly specific about what tires will be run.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, if you...
In that sense.
Yeah, if you can state the...
Right.
Yeah.
My drawings are fairly specific.
Fairly specific. I would say fairly.
For most people, though, it's not a good discussion point.
Yeah.
Or if they don't even know if it's in a sag state or something like that.
Yeah.
But
There's so many dynamic variables on a bike that... A lot of times, like, people ask me questions all the time of, like, what are these numbers? And I'm like, I don't know these numbers. I just know what to cut the tubes at. Like, I know what the bike's going to be.
Right.
And then I just know the manufacturing numbers.
Sure. Like, I mean...
I forget.
Right. But the thing is, we have this legend and lore shit. We have this old stuff of, like, oh, but this is what Eddie Merckx said.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, how many fucking years... did it take for people to stop saying that your stem length should be the same as your fork offset?
Right.
Why? Because who said that?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Who?
It was Greg Menar said that.
Oh,
in the interview.
Yeah.
He said your stem length should be the same as your fork offset back when fork offsets were 50 millimeters.
Well, that's what downhill forks still are.
Or, there you go. And so it's like, oh, that's what it should be. Okay. What does Greg Menar know about chassis design? That's not his job. He gets paid to go fast.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about chassis design, stem length and fork offset are so unrelated.
Yeah.
To draw a connection between those two things mm-hmm. is impossible.
Yeah, don't you have a reverse stem, right? Well, all of your bikes are... Well,
I place my grips where they belong.
Your grips are behind...
My grips are where they belong. Yeah. Oh, the steering axis one.
Yeah.
Oh, that fucking Richard Cunningham bullshit.
Yeah.
Where he published that, and then everyone was talking for, what, we're 4 years into that or something? Or 5 years in?
Yeah.
Of, oh, I don't want to have my grips behind my steering axis.
Yeah.
It's like, that isn't a thing.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean...
Like, that's literally not a thing at all.
Yeah.
Yet... Some imbecile wrote an article, and now it's a thing. And so we get buried in that in the cycling world. But mm-hmm. because you know, these other industries, it's like, no, they're busy making money and making shit real. They're measuring the right shit.
Yeah.
And in bike world, you know, every shop guy out there wants to be a frame builder because that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And despite...
Actually very cool.
It's not very cool.
It's a lot of hard work.
How's this? If you want to be one of those guys that sits around talking and records it for 3.5 hours about stupid little bike shop things, and it's just like...
If you want to work every day for the rest of your life...
The money's brutal, and it's like, it's hard work, but the point being is that we need to think better.
Yeah.
We need to change the way we think, and like... When you get into machine shop land and you're looking at metrology and you have your understanding, I want to see that understanding come through into bicycles, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Like, bicycling is the one that needs to be educated in all these ways. We, as in bicycles, there needs to be a better understanding on almost every level of it. Because it's largely just marketing bullshit
mm-hmm.
and legend and lore that isn't even meaningful or true.
Yeah.
And we have to stop pretending that the way you feel... I mean, this is a modern thing. Like, your feelings aren't fucking important.
Yeah.
The fact that you think you make good bikes doesn't mean they're good bikes.
Right.
Like, yeah, your mom thinks you did a cool thing.
Yeah.
It's like, I know, I was in kindergarten too. I got a gold star when I did something good.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like, we're measuring this against good work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, are you planning the project out well? Are you defining your goals? Are you drawing it in a way that represents a description that will meet that goal? And then are you analyzing it after? You said about me doing a post-mortem on my stuff.
Yeah.
Or a debrief.
Yeah.
It's like, we see lots of Instagram images of, look at the cool thing I made. And it's like, well, but no discussion after you wrote it the first time or more 2 months in.
Yeah.
Is this thing a piece of garbage? Like, I had a bike I made one time. I made this bike. This is back before I really started figuring things out. I made this bike. I went and rode it. And it was so bad, I went back and cut it up so I could get the dropouts out of it to use again.
Yeah. You know? Oh, man. I wish I had this motorcycle that I totally did that.
Yeah.
Like, I made, like, so there's a dirt track about 45 minutes from here. And I wanted to build a dirt bike into a dirt track bike.
Uh-huh.
And, but I was also going to like ride it on the street. And
oh, good.
I had
some, oh, good. That helps.
Yeah. I had some track tires on uh-huh. it.
But it also had to do like sick doubles.
Right.
Yeah. And it'd be a hill climber.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this thing's going to be rad. Like, got it all built up, you know, lowered everything, did the complete wrong thing to do, you know, with lowering suspension, you're right. Completely fucking all the geometry. And like, I think I rode the bike 100 yards, laid it on its side, track tires, it was in the winter, tires were hard, bike slid out from underneath me, laid it down, and I was like, that was such a mistake, I'm going to make it a bigger mistake. Chopped the back end of the dirt bike off and made it a hardtail. Just chop
it all in.
Just fuck it. Already ruined it. Let's make it worse.
Well, that's your style, you know. Just fucking keep hacking.
Yeah.
And yep. that. But we don't hear those stories.
Yeah.
Like that story about that bike. And what did you learn? And
yeah,
how does that change how you look at things now?
No, I was just thinking. I was like, I should probably like. People don't care. Like that's what I think is like. I want to make my mistakes public because I think that's a good thing to do. It makes, you know, it's a learning process for everything. But then it, I just think people don't care. Fuck it. You know, I'm not gonna say anything. But I think that bike I did. That's like one of the times I was like, it was so fucked. I cut it apart and made it a chopper.
Right. Just cut it up right away.
I actually just sold that bike like a couple months ago.
I just so think bummed. I think that we need to change what we care about and what are we talking about.
Yeah.
And especially in the current era where it's all like image based and everything like that, and everyone's trying to kill it on Instagram or whatever. It's like, to be able to sit there and say, this is the time I totally screwed up, and this is what I've learned from it, and this is how it's affected my decisions since. This is the wrong thinking that I had going into it.
Yeah.
Because we can talk all day about our successes, and look at this great part I made and all that stuff. It's like, yeah, but getting there was 1,000 mistakes.
Yeah.
Like, I made...
Getting there is half the battle.
I made a bunch of shitty bikes before I started making good bikes.
Yeah.
And then I had to make a bunch more bikes before they started getting great.
Yep.
And then I had to like actually clean up my whole act behind the scenes of that so that I could move that forward and just, and, but the thing is, it's like, if no one sees that, if everyone just sees like shiny paint job at a bike show and a geometry chart that makes no sense, then that's how they start into it. And they think that's the state of the art and it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, showing the full story, like, you know, I brag about, you know, that big lathe I just got was $775, but I'm 6,000 in running power to it.
You're 6,000 running power into it, and then you're going to find out, oh, it's worn out in this part of the travel.
Right.
Or something, and then you're going to have to, and it's like, I mean, that's an old, age-old story.
Yeah.
Of, look at how much I saved.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, you could have bought a single-phase
new lathe. Classic Adam. Yeah, that's classic me. Like, yeah, I mean, frugal. The single-car garage mentality, like,
right.
I'm not going to spend any money.
But frugality is important. And that is a motivator for a lot of my work. It's like, I don't want to spend any more money than I have to.
Yeah.
And luck... In the position I'm at, I can spend a lot more time than other people can.
Yeah.
So I can think about it before I... If I'm going to spend money, I've thought a lot about it.
Yeah.
Right? And so I can't just spend money without thinking about it. And also space. I can't have machine tools at home, blah, 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 right now. And I think frugality is very important and leads to some good decision-making.
Yeah.
The key, I think, is understanding when to be frugal and when to stop being frugal.
Yeah.
Like, there's a time you should just pony up with the money.
Yeah.
And there's other times where just solving problems with money is not solving problems.
Right.
It's lazy, and you may not be addressing the actual problem, you know. And anybody in the world we're in where, well, sure... There's always a thing for sale that would do the thing, but there's a carrying cost, there's a moving cost, there's a plugging it in cost, there's all, there's, yeah. I mean, like, what do the people say about buying a CNC machine? Expect to buy the machine plus the same cost for the tooling for the machine.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Easily.
Like that kind of thing. And it's like, no, you don't just buy the machine, you have to buy all the tooling, and that's going to be a whole nother thing. And there's times to, and we get wise. And this is a criticism I have for a lot of our schooling and what we teach young people. Because I care a lot about young people. Because I had a bad start.
Yep.
I had a shitty start. And it could have been better if there were wiser adults dispensing with better advice and wisdom for young people.
Yeah.
Rather than shitty advice or bad wisdom or no wisdom at all. And getting that out there and saying these things is helpful. Because when we see this, the young people making the same mistakes over and over again. Now, there's two problems there. Youth.
Yeah.
You know, youth will do this. Yeah. You know, they have a natural proclivity to be like, ah, fuck you, old man. I got this.
Yeah.
You know? But it's also a failure of the people around that young person.
Yeah.
Like, when you see a young person making the same old mistakes, that's a failure of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want them to make new mistakes.
Yeah.
That's a successful tribe.
Yeah. Then you learn.
The failing tribe has youth making the same mistakes as the older members.
Yep.
That's a failing tribe. And that's what we're in right now.
Yeah.
And
I agree wholeheartedly with that.
We need to get to a place where when you look at the young people, I want to be saying, well, son of a bitch, who could have predicted that? You know, that kind of thing. Rather than like, I told you that's how this story was going to end.
Yeah.
I mean, that is my failing. I didn't tell them well. Yeah. I didn't know how to communicate to them. I didn't say it in a way they understood.
Yep.
I didn't teach them a lesson that they were going to take. And, you know, you're going to have a Grom. Or you probably do have a Grom at this point.
Nope. Not yet.
You got to have a Grom.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you need a Grom. And it's like, those Groms need to, like, learn from that. So that, it's that thing of, like, I always say this, the goal, like, from, if you do the martial arts story type of thing, the goal is that the student kills the master.
Yeah.
And we have a problem in our society. The way we tell stories currently, the student always reveres the master.
Yep.
The student should end up thinking the master is an old fool. That the master is actually antiquated and is dead. Not because the student is arrogant, but the student has elevated to a point where that master is not a master anymore.
Yeah.
That's what we should be striving for.
That's one of my fears for going all out on my own, working in a shop by myself. And that's why I don't foresee this as a career path. This is just what I'm doing now, because some of the most important things I learned in life were from mentors and peers.
Absolutely.
At a job.
Totally.
Like, literally everything I know that is in, like, big machinery stuff in that garage was all from, like, a 4-year period. That's how quick everything can happen. I mean, I was...
When you're young, I mean, soaking it up.
My dad and my brothers definitely primed that.
And you were working hard and getting opportunities because you were showing up and working hard.
Yeah, and, like, I essentially taught myself how to weld in secrecy in our garage because my dad got a MIG welder, and I, like...
That's cool.
Used it, you know, in private, because I it wasn't okay for me yet, because that was probably 12, 13 or so.
Nowadays, given the cost of argon, I'd be flipping out because you used up all my argon.
Right?
I'd be like, are you kidding? You just poured that argon out on the floor?
Yeah. Like, yeah. So I took a welding class in high school, but like when I finished the 9-week course in like 2 weeks, because I was so eager. But at 14, I built my own scratch start TIG welder.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of people comment on my welds and they're like, oh, how can it be so good? And like my welds aren't perfect by any means. I take pictures of the good ones, obviously.
Of course, that's how Instagram works.
But I also have built bikes the same way. A bunch of times.
All right.
Like head tube welds, every bike has the same joint. Like you're going to get really good at that one because it's the same way.
Practice makes perfect.
Yeah. And I've also been welding for 20 years.
All right.
And so TIG welding for 20 years, that's going to make anybody pretty good. And I've never had more than like, I mean, the only time I had a TIG welder in my rented house in college, even.
Uh-huh.
Like,
right.
I've had a TIG welder pretty much where I lived.
That's your boy.
The whole time. Right. And so it's just, you know, but then I took on a production job of welding a bunch of stainless, and that's kind of where I learned everything. And like, I had to reach out to a lot of people along the way to learn what I was doing. And sure, I could be here and, you know, never ask any questions and I'll be a little hermit in my machine shop and never do anything cool. Right. But as long as like we keep this network up that we're doing and,
right.
and like, you're obviously putting this out into the world so other people can hear.
Well, that's what's so cool about these conversations is that think of who never gets to sit around and have a conversation with Adam and Pete.
Yeah.
And what do we talk about?
Right?
Yeah. No, because that's important. It's like, imagine you're some Grom somewhere and you're like, oh, I want to get into this. It's like, well, I'm listening to Adam and Pete or, you know, all the conversations that I've had
yeah.
and what comes out of people's mouths and what are they talking about? It's like, well, this is what people that do this stuff talk about.
Yeah, and maybe if you don't like the conversation, maybe you shouldn't listen.
Yeah, if you don't like this conversation, find a different path.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I call it a curse a lot. Like you're saying, a devil. Like, it is, like, a lot of things I do is a curse to myself and like, relationships. And I think doing a lot better these days.
How old are you?
34. No, 33. Uh-huh. Just had this conversation the other day. Yeah. I have a year that ends with a zero.
Oh yeah.
Steph me always too. Gives me shit for not knowing how old I am.
Right. I'm like that too. But I'm 1970, so it's like I'm 53. I'll be 54 soon.
Yeah.
That's a weird, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, but
I think this is where wisdom starts setting in.
Yeah.
Like in your mid 30s or so.
All of my wisdom is just passed out.
Right.
Like, I don't know anything new. It's, everything I have ever done is a copy. I'm just trying to do it the same way as I've seen it. And, like...
But aren't you mixing in? Aren't you, like... I mean, that's the thing. It's like, there's no such thing as new art or...
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's been done before and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like, yeah, but has anybody mixed that solution together the same way?
Yeah.
Right? That kind of thing. It's not that anything's new and you feel like it's a copy, but just like your approach to bikes is very different than most people's approach to bikes. I mean, you're a professional level rider. You're a professional level welder. You're a professional level machinist. Like you can, and you've worked with cars.
I can still suck at any of those, though.
Sure. We all have good days and bad days or whatever. No, but the thing is, it's like you have a competency in these several things that make up bicycle design and making.
Mm-hmm.
And not just all that, but you have a desire to bring your ideas to the world.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of people that are great welders or great whatever, but their ideas are not coming out into the world. You're giving birth. You're in the creative element type of thing, which is a struggle of its own, just creating.
Yeah.
Because it's so painful. I mean, you said being a critic, it's like, you know, I arrived at this, we probably arrived at the same, for the same reason, being so critical that fuck it, just give me the torch, I'll weld it myself.
Well, yeah.
Or whatever.
Like, I would almost say it is hard to be creative when you are a critic. And that's where
it either motivates you or destroys you.
Yeah, and that's part of what destroys me is I lack the ability to have like truly genuine design or, you know, being creative in a certain realm, but I can take influence from anything and create my own creativity. Like,
well, I talked like, with Ronan about how I want to teach him I want him to design better bikes.
Yeah,
and better tools for all this stuff.
Yeah,
so I can copy them. Like I say, I need you to solve these problems because I need to copy somebody.
Everybody copies everybody because you look at the part that works,
right?
And that's what you copy.
Well, that's the thing about fine art versus practical industrial art.
Mm-hmm.
Is that practical industrial art has to do something.
It has to function at the end of the day.
And you have to, like, your goal isn't to spend a lot of money on it. Mm-hmm. Your goal is to make it cheaper.
Yep.
And, well, some people figure out how to make things cheaper. Or looser tolerances. Or easier to procure materials. Or cheaper tools. Or, you know, all those sorts of things are, in a way, the art of engineering. But the thing is, it's like I tell when I'm around a student, I say, well, plagiarism is your first tool. Forget what they told you in school. The first thing you do is copy what other people do.
Yeah.
But there's a way to copy that's productive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like reverse engineering.
Yeah.
Where it's like if you learn how to reverse, and I've spent a lot of time working on how to reverse engineer and reverse engineering. If you notice, I've redrawn a lot of parts out there so that I can use them in my models. But the thing is, I had to reverse engineer them to get them there.
Yep.
Or drawing other people's bikes or figuring it all out. But the thing is, if you're reverse engineering well, you get into the mind of the person that designed it.
Yeah.
You know, you
like, what the fuck were they thinking?
Right. You either go, what the fuck were they thinking? Or you go, oh, that's how that works?
Yeah.
Oh. You know, and you're starting to do that. And it's like, well, yeah, you've copied what they had. But the thing is, if you're doing it well, you understand the problem they were solving specifically. Like, it could be the problem they were solving was a monetary problem and they were just finding a cheaper way. And then you get to evaluate, did it work? And then you critique it. It's like, well, this is a good, they did a really good job here. I've done plenty of things where I've started designing it. Once I was done designing it, I'm like, I have a whole new appreciation for what went into what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like I sat next to that person and got a lesson, yeah. Right? And not just that, it wasn't just a lesson like watching a YouTube video where you're passive and on the couch. I had to actively learn.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't just have them tell me. I had to actually start drawing construction geometry.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And make 800 planes and lines before I figured out, oh, this is the plane and line they're working with.
Yeah.
And it's like, so it's hard-earned learning from them. And it's very active learning. And by the end of it, it's like, you have a whole different way of thinking. And I mean, just the idea of copying in engineering is a weird concept, you know, especially when we have to institute such things as patents to ensure that nobody copies it right away or stuff like that. And it's also hard when we have a culture that says creative work is this and uncreative work is that.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you solving a problem and half the time is creative,
mm-hmm.
right? You solving a problem that it's lighter now or it's cheaper is creative. And attacking engineering problems with the same level of passion and discovery and excitement and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, discovery is huge. Like, most engineers aren't going to discover the reason why they're designing a certain element. Like, if you can get something to fail in the real world, you're going to learn way more than somebody just going by a parameter.
That's the Werner von Braun.
Yeah.
One good test launch is worth 1,000 expert opinions.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, totally. I mean, but there are some good engineers out there that, like Ronan, when I watch him get into some subject, it's like, he's like working with this, so he like goes down the wormhole.
Yeah.
And he learns all about that fucking thing, so that by the time he's coming up, he's totally informed about it. And we have to do the same thing, probably just a little bit more casual level than maybe a professional mechanical engineer does or whatever. But, you know, I mean, how many PhD dissertation papers have I looked at about bicycle handling that were wrong?
Yeah.
like it was wrong. Why? Because they actually didn't understand what they were describing in the first place. So whatever conclusion they come up with is foolishness.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could probably pull, if I spent an afternoon, I could pull up 20 PhD papers and I could show you that they're wrong.
Yeah.
Just in the first page. And that everything is built on that means the whole thing's wrong. And it's like, you've got to get into this shit. And so you don't just jump into bicycles and write a PhD paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you've been bicycling all your life. This is your fucking deal.
Yeah.
You get deep into this shit. And it's like, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
We both have a shared passion. And there's a lot of people that share this passion. It's like, what are they directed at? And how? You know? Sadly, racing stole a lot of oxygen from the room for a long time.
Yeah.
Where there's a lot of ways of looking at cycling. And, you know, as you age out of the racing class in general, it's interesting to see where you'll end up or maybe apply your competitive energies to, or what drives you for that type of thing. Because the mind of a younger man, and this gets into a young man, old man thinking, it's mm-hmm. like the mind of a young man is about certain, you know, gaining status and accumulating notoriety of sorts and getting, you know, climbing to the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And I think in a long ways, the the game of the older man is knowing they're on the right path. And it's a struggle, but it's a different, it's a slow, long adversary that'll never be conquered.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Versus the young man thinks it's like, this year I'm doing it. Right. And it's like the old man thinks like, I'm never doing it. I'm just going to continue to struggle.
Yeah.
You know? And those longer game things, and it's not like the physical race. It's like the spiritual gets probably bigger as you go in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the spiritual conquest. You know, what is it? Conquest of the self.
Yeah.
You know, right. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like those games become important, but it's an interesting thing. All right, we should wrap it up because it's actually getting dark now.
Yeah, right.
Jeez, what a day. All right. Now, say goodbye again.
It's only 3:50. If that clock's even right.
I know. It's going to be funny when I put this all together because this little addendum is an hour and a half.
You're going to have like, chapters.
All right. Goodbye.
See ya.
We're back. Okay, so, we're talking about tragic mistakes down here in the pit of Death City here.
So with your breadboard fixture style, we were talking about Waterford before.
Yeah.
So Standard got all of their equipment from Waterford because Waterford originally made Standards, and then Standard went all in-house, and they took all the equipment from Waterford.
Oh, okay.
And all of their tables are not necessarily breadboard, but they're T-slot style, all like tool steel.
Sure.
Flat.
Old Schwinn tooling.
Yeah. Horizontal building process. And what was really cool is they build all of the front triangles first, rack them, and then the front triangles go into a separate rear end jig. So that was really cool.
Is that one of those vertical rear end jigs?
Yep.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But when you draw a bike on paper and there's mistranslations into the game of telephone with your frame builder, things get set up wrong when there's no bottom bracket drop. And then your head angle goes to 71.5 degrees. So that's the bike that we're looking at now is it was
a standard 29 inch standard.
So this was,
I don't know how many 29 inch standards do you think have been, was this the only one or
no,
so?
No, there's probably, it's hard to say, maybe 20.
Wow. Okay.
You have
two of them?
I have three.
Okay.
So, this one was a single speed with the Hutch Trickstar style gusset.
Yeah, yeah.
That one was very cool.
Do you think that gusset is valid?
It looks cool.
Right.
It does something.
Okay.
But then the next one was when I went into a geared bike, but rear end clearance problems galore. We went to a 44 head tube. This one just got turned into a gravel bike because that's what all old mountain bikes do when they die.
You're killing me.
But this green bike is my first ever custom.
That's a standard as well?
Standard 250.
You're like the standard boy.
Well, that's where I'm from.
Yeah. But this was your geometry, and how old were you when you
this was not my geometry, but this was, I was probably 17.
Okay.
So this was 20 inch essentially geometry, but with 24 inch wheels. It was their, it was like their 20 inch dirt jump bike, the 250S, but it was also like street, like you could run pegs on it. But, I wanted to run 24 inch wheels cause I was tall.
So you basically said, I want these wheels. Do what you do to make these wheels work.
Yeah, exactly. So it's still pretty tight, steep head angle, tight. It's not necessarily race geometry. The rear end is a little bit shorter.
It wasn't intended to be a race bike.
Yeah, but it was meant to just be bigger wheels. But this was in the era of BMX that 24-inch wheels were only really BMX race wheels.
Sure.
So narrow, like 195 tires.
No, 175 in the rear.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it was so brutal.
So this one's tight. I can run a 195 rear. But
that's big clearance actually for that era.
Yeah. But this one was really cool. This was like the first full custom frame that I ever had anybody do.
Uh-huh.
And it's still a perfect bike.
What motivated you?
Like, I mean, I know that you're tall, obviously. Well, how tall are you exactly?
6'4".
6'4", so you're a legit tall dude.
Yeah, and riding a 20-inch BMX bike was just
It's silly. Weird. Yeah, it's silly. And but the thing is, it's like you're 17 years old. You, like, that wasn't a thing, really. I mean, you're talking about, what, 2005? 2000?
2007. Yeah.
I guess that probably was a thing around that time to make a request for a different wheel size.
Maybe. The big thing was I had already been looking into frame building at that point, but never had the capability to do it
myself. And you didn't think you could do it?
No. But I had somebody 10 minutes away that could do it.
That was standard.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're
so you're
like,
10 minutes from standard.
Yeah.
So
I grew up.
You were a grom.
My first bike after training wheels was a standard.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Dude, so you got into sick bikes early.
I've had a lot of standards.
Okay. Okay.
And so.
So you're a local kid and you're like, guys, build me a 24 inch. And then they do.
Yep. So I had probably 4 or 5 20s and like the last one got stolen. And then I got into the 24 realm because I wanted a little bit bigger bike. I had been riding mountain bikes a little bit. And I wanted a BMX bike with bigger wheels.
Sure.
So built that. I rode that for years. And then that's when we got into the 26 inch.
Right. Yeah.
And developed a good 26 inch bike with a short rear end. But this was kind of, I mean, there's like Black Market was doing dirt jumpers, but right. There's nobody in the US. So they applied all of the same BMX design and like design intent into a 26 inch bike. And it was amazing. I mean, this bike is still perfect. Mm-hmm.
And it did everything you wanted it to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then...
So, growing up as a skateboarder, I was connected with the BMX crowd. Like, I went... Like, we did Maximus Skate Park. Mm-hmm. So, we had a skate park, and we ran it, right? So, I hosted a couple bike nights. And we'd have bike nights, because bikes and skateboarders in an indoor skate park didn't really work out, but we were stoked on bike dudes. We didn't have anything against them.
Yeah.
So we'd shut down the park for bikers and just, they gave us a flat fee and they had the bike. They had the park until they were tired.
Yeah.
So it was called bike night.
Yeah.
And it was sick. I mean, I remember working those nights just being like, oh my God, these guys are psycho. What's weird is back then skateboarders were stoners and bike guys were drunks.
Yeah.
That was the thing.
The funny thing about this bike is it actually has steel pegs on it, uh-huh. But I always ran plastic pegs because all of the skate parks were skateboard parks.
Yeah.
And right. They wanted BMX bikes to run plastic pegs, even though trucks are metal.
It's true, but it's a very different type of impact.
The coping impact is
like
different.
I always had a problem with skate.
Not the coping, but the deck. Yeah.
Oh, you thought it was from peeling the deck? Because my thing is, if you had a section of pool coping,
yeah.
The bike pegs smash the coping up
so
that it's like, you can grind. Skate trucks are metal, but you'll grind it and it'll wear away.
Yeah.
But bike pegs take chunks out of coping.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you can't do 50-50 grinds anymore. And it's shit like that. And it's like super destructive.
Yeah.
And both sides were stupid for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I think things have settled down a bit.
Yeah, but with BMX, went into mountain bike, and then there wasn't, I raced BMX, but the competition wasn't really there. Small town BMX, you'd race against the same guys every week, and it wasn't a lot of fun.
BMX is a very tightly controlled environment. If
correct.
You're into mountain biking, it's sort of like, in motorcycling, there's sport bike, and there's dirt bike.
Yeah.
And it's like, sport bike is great for people that don't like chaos.
Yeah.
Dirt bike's good for people that like chaos.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sport biking is about hitting that same dime every corner.
Yeah.
And dirt biking is around what corner?
Yeah. Right.
What just happened, you know?
Yeah. So getting into college, I was meeting more people, riding more single track mountain bike. And then what do in the off season of mountain biking? You race cyclocross.
Right.
And since I was so in depth with standard, you get into the cross scene. And, like, you look in the True Temper catalog.
Oh, look at that.
Like, You're like, oh, I need right. True Temper S3.
Of course, you need that.
So that is a
standard cyclocross bike.
Yeah, 3 pound, 2 ounce.
Look at those chainstays.
Yeah,
dude, I wouldn't even
5/8 and half. 5/8 chainstays, half.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, 1 inch top tube, 1.8 down.
For a
tube.
Guy like you on a 1 inch yeah. top tube,
that boy. Bike complete steel frame, aluminum wheels. Sure, it has carbon cranks, but they're like yeah. you know force. It was 17 pounds flat.
Yeah, think of how much you saved.
Yeah, it's flexy motherfucker. If you look at all the welds,
yeah,
all the powder coat is cracked around the welds because everything flexes so much.
That's so wild.
Yeah. Look at that head tube.
Jesus.
The thinnest head tube.
What's weird is it's also it's not a BMX style head tube.
No.
But I guess this isn't either.
This was 44.
Uh-huh.
This was what they actually used.
That's a proper BMX head tube.
BMX integrated.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the kind of learning all of the...
You're in standard country. But that's all like... That's farmland shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's where you grew up, in farmland.
I mean, I lived in the city.
Okay.
Well, yes, farmland.
Was it Madison that's close by there?
I lived in Davenport, so right on the Mississippi River.
Okay.
I mean, there's 120,000 people in our town. But, I mean, this thing, I think this single-speed 29 frame was 4.5 pounds.
Dude, you're not impressing me. You're, like, you're killing me
you.
Here.
Yeah. Never broke yeah. any of them.
I mean, it's yeah, got this that one big was, gusset. It's just...
Yeah.
It's just an interesting...
This is where a lot of the laser cut stuff... started.
Uh-huh. And you designed that laser cut?
No, this is just what Standard used, and okay. I wanted them to use it on
so
my
you
bikes.
Saw them using that, and you're like, oh, laser cut's the way to go.
Yeah, I'm like, look at these dropouts. I mean, the tiny laser cut, thin
it's dropouts. So painful. And you can see, does this bend? This one bent? No, it's straight.
I think they're pretty straight. Yeah. But that's, on my single speed, I had those tiny, thin, you know, eighth plate dropouts, and they're perfect if you can keep the tube section close enough to create it. If you have a big plate, it's going to bend. But yeah. if you can keep the...
Sure, and there's ways of getting it to small. Happen, but I've never been a fan of those tiny things, especially mainly because, like, your hands are probably...
Damn Magura rim brakes.
Yeah, yeah. Magura rim brakes over here on a Schwinn Varsity or something.
Yeah.
No, but, like, you were working on a bike. You had a history of working with things. But, like, in BMX land, most BMX bikes are going into the hands of a kid that their only tool is a half-inch breaker bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the way they see the world.
Yep.
And so...
Or vice grips yeah, to the seat post.
Right. And it's like, those kinds of things don't lend themselves to that environment. But Standard's a premium brand, too, so you got that.
Yep.
All right, we're going to cut audio off again. We got to cut it off.